Good morning. Lost one of my pages and they're not numbered, so that's great. Okay. Well, you get, let me try and not make this echo. You get me for Palm Sunday, which is, I don't really know, being put on Palm Sundays. I don't know, normally people have palm fronds waving around and tickling each other in the ear, and nobody's here because they're all going to come next week and stuff. So you get me. I'm not sure what that means, but so let's talk about some things this morning. And I have another sermon. When is that? You just arbitrarily decide when to give. There's no rhyme or reason.
You got the schedule 6 months ago.
I did not. I got the schedule for the second sermon like 3 weeks ago. So anyway, it's in May sometime, so I'll be back up here. So. It's unfortunate for you. So several years ago, maybe some of you will know to what I'm referring, I was listening to a debate involving William Lane Craig. I'm sure most of us have listened to one or another of his debates. He's had plenty, continues to have plenty. It was about the existence of God. And during the question and answer period, following the debate, a young man stood up and stepped to the microphone, and with very little, let's say, charity in his speech, you can tell these folks coming a mile away because the first words out of their mouth are just dripping with incredulity and nonsense. But anyway, he asked Dr. Craig why anyone would ever or should ever become a Christian. He mentioned that he had some particular things about his own life that he enjoyed, things we won't mention with his girlfriend and other such things that he didn't want to abandon if he were to embrace Christianity. He talked of our Western culture kind of having moved beyond Christianity as an archaic belief system, and he kind of heaped scorn on Christians in general who might have infantile, in his view, motivations for believing in Christianity and the dogmas associated with Christianity. And so he said, well, why would any normal, rational person call themselves a Christian and mean it? He kind of put the question. And so Dr. Craig, as he does, he carefully measures out his words typically, and he paused for a moment, and he, with a bewildered look on his face, he explained to the young man that he should believe Christianity because it's true. And this response, in the context of that particular debate, caused the audience to chuckle, laugh a bit. And that exchange has stuck with me ever since I heard that. And it has come up in one form or another over the years in his debates. You see, the audience's laughter and the mere presence of the question in the first place from the young man, absent the attitude with which he asked it, illustrate that our presentation of the gospel in the West has not really, as we know, properly focused on the most important thing, which is the truth or falsity of the core Christian claims. We talk of heavenly rewards for believers, a sense of belonging. There are plenty of new studies now that show the psychological benefits of belief in God, societal acceptance, at least in the past in our culture, material blessings, plenty of name it, claim it folks out there will obviously promise those things, so on and so forth, and when we tout the positive benefits of Christianity to others. And so this young man considered the pros of what he thought Christianity was offering against the perceived benefits of his unbelieving life. And he thought he saw clearly the obvious answer to the question. And of course, he's right on some level. If the central concern of evangelism is bettering the condition of a particular person or a particular group in missionary work or whatever it is, then unbelievers can readily and easily and quite rightly reject the gospel unequivocally if they enjoy their lives sufficiently. If they think, well, I like my life well enough, if Christianity's main promise is to better my life, it's already great, I don't want Christianity. So the name of the game for the Great Commission specifically and Christianity in general, as we know, has never been the conferment of an improved life, but the truth grounded in reality. And this is why I think Dr. Craig's response elicited some laughter. It was an abrupt stripping away of all the subsidiary considerations of Christianity, and it cuts straight to the heart of the matter at hand. If you believe Christianity first because it is true, setting aside all other concerns. you may derive benefit incidentally, or more likely if we read Jesus' promises as we should, we may derive more hardship than benefit from becoming a believer. But this is a mere consequence rather than the impetus for adhering or believing in a particular religion. So the questioner and audience, from Dr. Craig's words, thus instantly had their minds decluttered, shaking their heads a bit, chuckling that they had given so much credence to things that only mattered on the periphery of worldview consideration. So my aim this morning is not to chide us for approaching evangelism wrongly. I mean, we know that as a church. We've talked about that plenty. I believe most of us in this room, and I hate quoting people on LinkedIn quote, but Stephen Covey, he says, keep the main thing, and I think in the context of evangelism, we're probably at least okay at doing that. When we keep the main thing regarding sharing the truth of Christianity, we're talking about the core claims of Christianity and give our reasons why they're to be believed. So what I'd like to do instead is think a little bit more in depth about what truth is, and using the Gospel of John as a bit of a vehicle to do so. John, after all, for those of you who, I mean, we all should be studying the Gospels, but it's set aside from the Synoptics as it has a very particular style. And if you're going to categorize one Gospel over the others as more philosophical, perhaps, than the others, more reflective, certainly it's the latest Gospel. And so John has much more time than the others, specifically Mark and so forth, to ruminate on the content that he's presenting from Jesus and the biography of Jesus that he's presenting. Certainly, we would expect John to be more philosophical, and I think there are some very key passages in John that help kind of illuminate the topic of truth in a really interesting, fascinating way. So I think it has a great deal to teach us about the topic. So part of this will be philosophy. Part of it will be exegesis of particular passages. I'm just going to look at three passages. And part of it will, if my past sermons are of any use to us, part of it will just be dumb. So we'll see what part that is. And none of it will be Chesterton, I promise. No Chesterton quotes. Wegman couldn't believe it. He's going to stay. So that's great. So before we look at John, then, we need to agree what we're talking about when we speak of truth. We won't spend a lot of time on this, but it may not surprise you to know that there's quite a bit of discussion behind the scenes from philosophers and theologians regarding what this term actually means. And so we bandy the term about all the time. We talk about it, but we rarely stop to think about what it is. And Wendell in the past has kind of given us a working definition. He has mentioned that basically when something is true, a belief is true from us, we are more or less thinking God's thoughts about it. And that propositional content that lines up with the way that God thinks about the world is truth. And I think that that's a good jumping off point for us this morning. So there have been a few approaches over the years that have been floated. If you were subjected to, or for some reason electively chose to pursue studies in philosophy in college, Josh Birch, why I don't know why he would do that, but anyway. So and some of you are deriving great benefit, I'm sure, from his logic class. Is anyone enjoying that a fair bit? Okay. If I asked you what modus ponens is, would you be able to tell me?
Not yet.
Not yet. What are you doing with them? My gosh, you've had 2 weeks. Okay. Anyway, he's teaching the class. I'm not. All right. So you may have come across these. We're just going to go over them very, very, very briefly. I promise. It may put you to sleep. I hope it doesn't. There are several different approaches in philosophy that have been used to kind of get at what is truth. Let's talk about a theory behind it. And the two primary ones that we'll just mention briefly are the coherence theory and the pragmatic theory, neither of which we would traditionally hold. So advocates for the coherence theory, you may have heard of a couple of these guys, Spinoza and Hegel, two kind of seminal figures in the history of philosophy. They contended that someone's belief is true if it meshes, so fits in or coheres well with the rest of that person's beliefs. So think of someone's belief system as a spider web of beliefs. If all those beliefs fit together well, then we can say that the individual beliefs that make up that web, what Plantinga calls kind of our noetic structure, that would be, all those individual beliefs would be true because they cohere well together. My belief that I can beat up Josh Miles is true to the degree to which it lines up with my other beliefs that I'm in excellent shape and I've mastered many different martial arts and I know a secret spot to punch him in the shin bone where he's exceptionally vulnerable. And if we kind of talk about it for just a minute, we can see the fatal flaw, or at least one of the fatal flaws of coherence theory, which is that many beliefs, like the spider web, like in a spider web, may fit together well, but they might create an intricate tapestry of interconnected beliefs. But that doesn't stop the whole web from being like an edifice of lies and delusion, right? My belief system, my network of beliefs associated with beating up Josh and being able to beat up Josh is, I mean, like we haven't really tried, but I mean, like all the evidence from objective third parties would point to me just getting annihilated. And so, a further problem is that when I attack Josh and then I subsequently have my airway collapsed, then how will I assimilate that newfound experience into my web of belief, into the other things that I, at least up until that point, held true? Well, if I'm just thinking about it in terms of, well, I've got all these beliefs that I can really kick his butt, and then I've got this belief that I didn't kick his butt because I'm struggling for air and on the ground, what will I conclude? Well, the likelihood is, on the preponderance of evidence, one thing against the network of beliefs, that I'll probably conclude, well, he just got lucky. And that's clearly, we call that lunacy most of the time, and that term gets thrown around a lot in my house, by the way. Not by me. Yeah. So if we switch gears from the coherence theory to the pragmatic theory, some folks that have held this over the years, you will have heard of William James, one of the great American philosophers, John Dewey, Richard Rorty, have all been proponents of this. And the main contention here is that a belief is true, or something is truth-making insofar as it is useful for somebody to hold it. In other words, if it's useful to me to accomplish my ends, regardless of how good or bad or weird those ends might be, through believing a particular set of propositions or proposition, then the proposition is true. And so the best way to convince my children and wife to leave for church on time every Sunday is for all of us to collectively believe wholeheartedly that the house is on fire, then this is a belief with true content, propositional content that is true. If the most helpful way to get through the workday is to believe that I have a realistic probability of winning the evening's Powerball drawing, then the belief is true. And of course, you can see problems here pretty quickly. The advocates of pragmatic theory have to adopt an anti-realist view of the world. There's nothing that their beliefs necessarily line up with or correspond to, which gives a hint to what we'll actually be talking about this morning. There's no external reality we discover. There's nothing that lines up with what we think. Further, the theory collapses into relativism, with people believing contradictory things and no way to say who's right or wrong. There's no arbiter of truth under the pragmatic theory. And lastly, how useful a proposition is an arbitrary measurement, just as it's an arbitrary measurement when deciding, regarding the personhood of the unborn, for instance. It's arbitrary. Why not make the criteria what is the most whimsical to me rather than the most useful or the most wasteful or selfless or whatever, anything else? You can see the problems. So outside of these two theories, we have many more what we'll call mystical, Eastern, and other non-realist positions. We won't get into those, that deny the existence of truth altogether. And I hate to say that it's like, I hate to not give credence to those particular belief systems, but I think anyone who wants to discuss the topic of truth has to already kind of have moved on from anti-realist, nominal, and truth-denying Eastern thought regarding them anyway. So so we won't do much to it. And of course, we know that these approaches just collapse into self-refutation anyway. Any philosophy or religion or worldview that's going to deny the existence of truth is going to be self-contradictory when examined closely. So that leaves us with the common sense, biblical, and traditional position on the nature of truth, which is called the correspondence theory. You may have heard of this before. If not, this is what you normally think when you think about truth anyway. J.P. Moreland says, in its simplest form, the correspondence theory of truth says that a proposition or a sentence or belief is true just in case it corresponds to reality, when what it asserts to be, when what it asserts to be the case actually is the case. So when it lines up with when a propositional content lines up with the way the world actually is, right? Which is what we all know to be true. Millard Erickson, is a systematic theology, says God and reality are what they independently are of anyone's perceiving, understanding, appreciating, or accepting. While the knower's reaction, that is, while our reaction to truth is important, and the way reality is important, truth is not dependent on our reaction. And William James himself, whom we talked about earlier, summed up the position well, even though he didn't hold to it. He said, truth means agreement, and falsity means disagreement with reality. So objective reality is independent of those who hold the beliefs about it, and we either further align ourselves with that reality by apprehending things as they actually are, or we disalign ourselves by entertaining lies, right? Wolfhard Pannenberg, who is Dr. Craig's doctor father in Munich, he says that by its very nature, truth precedes subjective insight. For seekers after knowledge may either hit upon truth or miss it. If actual truth does not precede, then we cannot miss it. So notice that we're talking about how we come, we're not talking about how we come to hold particular beliefs. That's another subject for another day. We're just talking about what those beliefs are and what truth is. So the correspondence theory, as you might suspect, in calling it a common sense approach, enjoys the most support philosophically, as it's really the only system that allows philosophy to be reliably done in the first place, right? You can't just argue against it and then try and build an edifice on top of it. It doesn't really work. The theory also enjoys the preponderance of support from the scriptures, which we'll look at here in just a moment. As the existence of an independent God-sustained reality apart from individual people is presupposed over and over and over again, and that's why we really come to adopt it. Psalm 105 says, God's truth endures to all generations. Isaiah 45:19 says, I, the Lord, speak truth. I declare what is right. Psalm 86:11 relays the entreaty of the psalmist to teach me your way, O Lord, that I may walk in your truth. So basically, line me up with the way things really are. And Hebrews 11:26 speaks of receiving knowledge of the truth. The whole of the creation narrative in Genesis, additionally, shows that true reality and God and the created order are distinct from the mind and existence of his people. Notice that the scriptures further presuppose that God expects his people to find truth and to live by what they discover. So though the correspondence theory is clearly the most helpful to us, it also reinforces kind of a troubling thought that we should all have at one time or another, which is truth lies outside of us, right? That is both good and bad. It's great that it's not contingent on us because we're idiots a lot of the time, but that also means that we have to go look for it, and the degree to which we can apprehend it is debatable. And aside from ultimate reality being other than us, and us needing to find a way to bridge that divide, we have the complicating matters of finitude and sin. We are finite and we are sinful. The problem will be daunting enough if we strode out into the world bent on discovering truth, but the Bible is clear that we're created with limited, finite capabilities as contingent beings, and that with our decision-making power, we have chosen ultimately to introduce the clouding, poisoning, incapacitating perniciousness of sin, which doesn't help things. Thus, not only do we find ourselves separate from the truth, but we have no realistic chance to lay hold of it given our starting point. Yet by the grace of God, who grounds all truth and who is himself true, he affords us corrective lenses to see through our sinful, clouded vision. He affords us glimpses behind the epistemic veil into the way things really are. And he discloses himself with ever-increasing clarity in our hearts, in the world, in the scriptures, in other people, in the church, in miraculous deeds, and ultimately in the revelation of the incarnate Word, the one true God, Jesus of Nazareth. And so the Gospel of John paints the conduct and person of Jesus as being wholly concerned with truth. John is, of course, as we said, the most philosophical of the four Gospels, and it should be unsurprising that the most profound and revelatory teachings and interactions of Jesus are recorded within John's pages. Within our time left this morning, I just want us to look at three passages from John. One is much more brief than the other two, but if you have your Bibles, the first passage we're going to look at, I'm going to have it up on the screen, but it may be a little difficult to read, is going to be John 8, 25 through 47. And in this passage, Jesus is in discussion with Jewish leaders in Jerusalem during the Feast of Tabernacles. There's a great deal of buildup here. We won't get into all the context. And again, I know it's probably a little difficult to read. That's my fault. We can safely jump in to verse 25 here without missing a tremendous amount. So verse 25 says, "So they," the Jewish leader, "said to him, 'Who are you?' And Jesus said to them, 'Just what I've been telling you from the beginning. I have much to say about you and much to judge, but he who sent me is true, and I declare to the world what I have heard from him.' They did not understand that he had been speaking to them about the Father. So Jesus said to them, 'When you have lifted up the Son of Man, then you will know that I am he, and that I do nothing on my own authority, but speak just as the Father taught me. And he who sent me is with me. He has not left me alone, for I always do the things that are pleasing to him.'" "As he was saying these things, many believed in him. So Jesus said to the Jews who had believed in him, 'If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you'll know the truth, and the truth will set you free.' They answered him, 'We are offspring of Abraham and have never been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say you will become free?' Jesus answered them, 'Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin. The slave does not remain in the house forever. The son remains forever. So if the son sets you free, you will be free indeed. I know that you are offspring of Abraham, yet you seek to kill me because my words find no place in you. I speak of what I have seen with my father, and you do what you have heard from your father.' They answered him, 'Abraham is our father.' Jesus said to them, 'If you were Abraham's children, you would be doing the works that Abraham did. But now you seek to kill me, a man who has told you the truth that I heard from God. This is not what Abraham did. You are doing the works your father did.' They said to him, 'We were not born of sexual immorality. We have one father, even God.' Jesus said to them, 'If God were your father, you would love me, for I came from God and I am here. I came not of my own accord, but he sent me. Why do you not understand what I say? It is because you cannot bear to hear my word. You are of your father, the devil, and your will is to do your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in truth, because there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks out of his own character, for he is a liar and the father of all lies. But because I tell the truth, you do not believe me. Which of you convicts me of sin? I tell you the truth. Why do you not believe me? Whoever is of God hears the words of God. The reason why you do not hear them is that you are not of God." Okay, so a lot going on here. We're not going to dwell upon, we're not going to go verse by verse, but let's take this in chunks as to what's going on here. So in verses 25 through 30, we hear Jesus reiterate, and this is a theme that maybe is not clear upon the first reading of the scriptures, if you're new to them, but over time you come to realize how deferential and humble Jesus's words are regarding his intent, his mission, his truth, as they all relate back to his relationship with the Father and his utter dependence on the Father. so that Jesus is the disclosure of truth about the Father. This is what this passage, this first portion of the passage is about. The Father, and by extension Jesus as his messenger, is the embodiment of truth, which will be fully revealed once the Son is, in Jesus' words, lifted up. Of course, the crucifixion was the Son's ultimate act of obedience. We will discuss that, obviously, and not celebrate it, but observe it on Good Friday. And this is the ultimate act of humility towards the Father and towards the Father's intentions. And it conveyed the gospel message that would only be made fully clear after the resurrection. In verses 31 through 38, this is kind of the meat and potatoes of the passage, we see Jesus fleshing out what it means to be a disciple of his and adhere to the truth. The many who believed in him from verse 30, this is a little bit of a difficult passage in that if you see in verse 30, it says, as he was saying these things, many believed in him, but immediately afterwards, so Jesus said to the Jews who believed in him, if you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples. Then he goes on to question their true belief. So more than likely, there are a number of theories as to who these people exactly are and what they've gotten wrong. But it can be reasoned that just as John describes in a couple of other passages, these are insincere believers who perhaps first assented to the truth, but then weren't willing to live it out. So in one of the most beautiful and hope-filled passages, and this is my favorite verse and probably sticks out the most to all of us in this passage, in this broader passage, Jesus promises, if you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples and you'll know the truth and the truth will set you free. And so notice two huge things that his words presuppose here. First, we were designed and oriented by God towards truth. Our Creator has so created us that freedom, flourishing, security, and true knowledge of God will only come about as we draw nearer to the truth. It is, of course, no accident that abiding with Jesus and partaking in a deepening discipleship under him will inexorably familiarize us with the truth about God, man, sin, the universe, and the life to come. That is no accident. We were made for and oriented towards truth. As we draw towards that truth through the power of the Holy Spirit, we flourish more and more. This God-given and Spirit-sustained orientation towards truth, though eroded by our own wickedness and sin, is present to varying degrees in all who bear God's image. Through his grace, God has afforded us all the privilege or the ability and privilege to find truth and consequently find him. By and large, we can appeal to both believers and unbelievers alike with the Socratic appeal, the classic Socratic appeal of follow the evidence, follow the truth where it leads. And it will resound, however faintly, with the manner in which God has made all people. So this is a common appeal that I think we can make in evangelism and oftentimes take it for granted, that we would appeal to the truth and that that would be the common point in our discussion. We don't appeal to expediency. We don't appeal to good feelings. We don't appeal to benefit being conferred on somebody. We appeal to the truth and let the truth speak for itself. By and large, we do not appeal to one another in times of disagreement on this other stuff, right? What is familiar, what is self-serving, what is expedient, what is wicked, so forth. We appeal to one another to act, change, behave, believe, and live differently on the basis of what is true. So we love detective novels. We love Sherlock Holmes. We love Father Brown. We love even contemporary crime shows on television. And why do we love those in the West? Well, I think it's because of Christian influence. I think it's because we secretly know, and perhaps just the way that we're wired, that truth will win out. Truth will have its day. Truth will rise above lies and deceit and ill will. Our collective moral sense of justice and fairness is predicated also on a shared hope that truth will have its day and all wrongs will be righted. And the thing with which we all seem to be ultimately concerned as people, even the most hardened and far from God in terms of unbelievers, the thing which we all agree upon is that the fulcrum upon which history pivots is truth. It's truth that matters and then that we dig down to find. As Jesus says here, truth is liberating and it is freeing. and it is to set the trajectory of our lives. Paul tells us in Philippians 4:8 that whatever is true, whatever is honorable, you know that passage, think about those things, dwell upon them. But if Jesus says in verse 32 that the truth will set his listeners free, what does that presuppose? Presupposes that they're currently enslaved, which is not something the Pharisees wanted to hear, surprisingly. So the Jewish leadership is ticked off. They hear Jesus say, the truth will set you free. What the heck? Didn't know we were enslaved, Jesus. Okay, we're the offspring of Abraham. We've never been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say you will become free? You can just hear the smug self-righteousness dripping from their lips. They're just resenting this whole implication, right? Their attitude is stunning for a couple of reasons. One that Jesus gets into, one that he doesn't, which is, I find, more hilarious. But they are under Roman occupation and rule, right? They are under Roman military occupation. And the very city where they're having this discussion is occupied to the highest degree out of anywhere in Judea, Samaria, Galilee, by Roman forces. And so they probably can actually see Roman soldiers while they're talking. And so this is just lunacy. We have never been enslaved to anyone. Oh, really? It's happening right now. And then they further... idiots. They then say they appeal to Abraham and they say, basically, we've never been enslaved to anyone. Abraham is our father. Well, if the Jewish history is characterized by anything, it is periods of marked enslavement to other people. And like, if they're going to go back that far, surely they, in their bookending their discussion like that, surely they have to understand that Jesus is going to see right through this and that they're being absurd, right? So Jesus makes it clear to them there's another important enslavement that they're missing here. Not just the Roman occupation, not just the historical oppression of the Jewish people by Pharaoh and by others, but he says to them, truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin, right? The slave does not remain in the house forever. The son remains forever. So if the son sets you free, you will be free indeed. Sorry, I forgot to change that. I know that you are the offspring of Abraham. So Jesus says, yeah, I get that. I hear you guys. You're clear about that. Yet you seek to kill me because my words find no place in you. I speak of what I have seen with my father, and you do what you have heard from your father. So according to Jesus, it is sin of which the Jewish leaders didn't think they were guilty, which is their imprisoning force. Jesus tells them that to remedy this enslavement, they'll have to align themselves with he and his father, with him and his father, since he is the only one who can set them free. Notice that in the previous passage, Jesus said the truth would set the listeners free, and now he equates himself with the truth, right? He says, the truth will set you free, and then later he says, I will set you free. Easy connection. Further, his word of truth finds no place in the hearts of these men. Thus, they have no hope of being set free. No hope of being spiritually set free. No hope of being physically set free. Lastly, Jesus disputes whether Abraham is the true father of these men, and you can see where this conversation is going. Jesus' words here, as his teaching does elsewhere, show us that it is not mere intellectual agreement with reality that constitutes true belief. It is action and fidelity which accompany the mental assent to truth, right, to a proposition. It will simply not do to agree with such a proposition as God is one or Jesus is God and then not behave accordingly. And of course, we know the famous passage from James that illustrates this point, an example of demons believing and mentally assenting to truth, yet not following it through with conduct, with fidelity. No, for Jesus, abiding, remaining faithful and persevering towards his word is part and parcel of truth, along with knowing who he is and what he teaches. It's obvious then that the distinction and the disjunct lies, this is where it lies for the majority of human sin. We know it's bad to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, but our conduct does not follow our mental agreement. We realize that God is Lord of our lives, but we still self-crown ourselves as kings over and over and over again. Jesus' revelation of truth is all-encompassing and it is total. if we and the Jewish leaders would only heed it and obey as Jesus obeys the Father, we would be set free and flourish more and more into the people God designed us to be. But as it is, we do not. So after insinuating that the Jews' father is someone other than Abraham in verse 38, the Jews are like, wait a second, wait. Abraham is our father. Let's make that clear, which they've done already plenty of times. Jesus tells them that by their deeds, in verse 39, that they have aligned themselves with Satan, not Abraham. The Jews were actively trying to kill Jesus, and all Jesus had done to them was tell them the truth in an attempt to set them free. Notice that as Jesus questions their lineage, they in turn question his, right? And if we're not careful, we can miss this huge insult that they heap on him, right? They say, we were not born of sexual immorality. We have one Father, even God. This is an insult that we miss in much the same vein as we miss it when the Jewish leaders call Jesus the son of Mary. Why are they calling him the son of Mary? Because he was an illegitimate son, had no father to which they would accord his name, and so they call him son of Mary. And they say, we are not illegitimate children, with the insinuation, you are an illegitimate child. Who are you to talk of fatherhood? Who are you to talk of lineage? You have no lineage. And so Jesus brushes this off. He could have gone down that road, but he brushes it off. So they try and discredit or rebuke his points on that basis, which is crazy. In verses 43 through 47, Jesus tells the Jewish leaders that they cannot hear his words or accept his offer of rescue because they listen to the lies of their father, Satan. Jesus says of the devil, he does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. If these men choose to ally themselves with Satan instead of Jesus, their lives will be characterized by lies and the privation of truth. It must be this way, since there's no truth, life, or goodness apart from the fount and source of such things. Jesus here offers himself as a remedy to the destructive, sinful, twisting nature of truth, of lies that Satan engages in. Jesus mentions that the character of Satan and his followers is of such a nature that really all they do is lie. All they can do is intrinsically pervert and distort the truth that Jesus embodies. C.S. Lewis makes this point very well in the Screwtape Letters. All Satan has the capability to do is take what is already there and twist it and tweak it a little bit so as to pervert it. He can't create anything of his own. The great commandment given to Moses, do not lie, is impossible to follow if you take your directions and instructions to abide in the work of somebody who only ever lies and call him your father. We also know that the nature of lying is much different from the nature of truth-telling, right? The truth, as Jesus does, speaks for itself. It's confident, it's life-giving, it's liberating. By contrast, lies, by their very nature, only destroy and multiply upon one another. How do you masquerade a lie as truth? Well, you create more lies, right? The enslavement to all that is outside of the truth is a progressively ensnaring and bondage-inducing enterprise. The only escape, as Jesus has argued, is an unwavering alliance with the truth and the Father, and that's him. That's through him. So next, I know we're running short on time here. This is a very, very brief passage, one that you all be undoubtedly well familiar with, so we won't spend hardly any time here. In John 14, 6 and 7, Jesus says to Thomas, to a question that Thomas has, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you had known me, you would have known my Father also. From now on, you know him and have seen him. And of course, this fits in thematically with what has just gone on in chapter 8. It goes without saying, but notice the article that is used for each of the way, the truth, and the life. As Americans, we have a habit of attaching the article the to things that aren't singular or maybe aren't being referred to in the clearest way. I had this conversation with a British person some time ago where he said, you Americans talk about the lake and the store and the concert. And it's like, well, there's more than one, right? I mean, like, where there are lots of stores around. There are a few lakes. There's maybe more than one concert happening. Maybe not in Fort Wayne, but there's more than one concert going on, right? So so this is just something that we do. But, of course, here it's not an accident. The articles are precise. They're limiting. There's nothing other than Jesus to satisfy these particular descriptors. So in John 14:6, there's no mistake. The way, one way. The truth, one life, one life. The life, one life. As D.A. Carson notes, Jesus is specifically the truth because he embodies the supreme revelation of God. He narrates God for us. He is God's gracious self-disclosure. His word was made flesh. John 1:18 tells us that no one has ever seen God, and the only God who is at the Father's side, Jesus, has made him known. And of course, just to wrap up on John 14:6, Thomas A. Kempis has a neat meditation on this. He says, "Without the way, there is no progress. Without the truth, there is no knowledge. Without the life, there is no living. I am the way you must follow, the truth you must believe, the life for which you must hope. I am the imperishable way, the infallible truth, the eternal life. I am the most notable way, the ultimate truth, the true life, blessed and uncreated. If you remain in my way, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." So lastly, on John 14:7, to wrap this up, we see Jesus' continual emphasis on revealing the character, truth, and the will of the Father. To Thomas's preceding question about knowing the destination and the path of Jesus, Christ points to all that he has ever taught the disciples about the Father. So our final passage for today is the coolest one, I think. And again, we will not take nearly as long on this as we did on the first. But it is the discussion of at least the first half of the discussion between Jesus and Pontius Pilate. And this is found in John 18:33-38, if you care to turn there. The second half occurs in 19:9-11. We won't look at that as because there's not enough time. But perhaps there's no greater confrontation or interesting conversation anywhere in the New Testament, anywhere in the scriptures aside from here. So just briefly to read it together. So Pilate entered his headquarters again and called Jesus to him and said, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "Do you say this of your own accord, or did others say it to you about me?" Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you over to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not of this world." Then Pilate said to him, "So you are a king?" Jesus answered, "You say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is on the side of truth listens to me, or everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" And notice what happens right off the bat here. The man of the dock and the prosecutor have switched roles almost immediately. Pilate reiterates a question of Jesus' kingship that he likely only is parroting from the Sanhedrin's kangaroo court that has just finished up. Jesus, in turn, asks for the motivation and the source of this question. Pilate shoots back in verse 35, indicating that Jesus' case ought not to be any of his concern as the chief Roman representative of Judea. This is kind of small peanuts. Jesus has been foisted upon Pilate by an unruly mob of Jews, and the last thing Pilate wants is another Maccabean uprising on his hand, another issue to take care of and have to answer to the emperor for. Despite Pilate's possible contempt and mixed motivations for asking Jesus about being king of the Jews, Jesus graciously clarifies his kingship in verse 36. Clearly, if Jesus' kingdom had been primarily of this world, he would have embraced the messianic misconception that the Jews had of him for the past 3 years, right? This whole theme of the messianic secret where Jesus, people say, "Hey, you're the Messiah," and Jesus says, "Ooh, keep that a secret. Don't tell anyone. Well, why do we think he did that? In part, it's because the Jews had very mixed understandings about who the Messiah was. As we well know, they thought he would be this Davidic warrior king, and perhaps even some on Palm Sunday who are bowing down before him were anticipating this entry into Jerusalem where he would throw off Roman rule and give them everything their hearts desired. And so, Jesus, up until this point, has kind of kept away from associating himself as a king, as a Jewish king. But here, he both negatively defines what his kingship is, and then he positively does as well. At the very least, if his kingship were of an earthly nature, he would have stopped Simon Peter from cutting off Malchus's ear. I mean, he did stop Simon Peter from cutting off Malchus's ear, but if his kingdom were of this world, he'd been like, cut the other one off, and let's stab some people. That's great. But no, though he was inaugurating the kingdom of God on earth, as he testified in his message to John the Baptist, you recall John the Baptist sends a message to him from prison saying, hey, are you the one we should expect? And he sends a message back basically saying, yes, I'm the promised Messiah. I'm doing all these things. The blind are receiving the sight, the lame walk, all this stuff is happening. This is the inbreaking of the kingdom of God. So it is happening, but his kingship affiliation and consummation lay beyond the local, political, and chronological kind of narrowness of Judea, Samaria, and Galilee in the first century. Jesus allays Pilate's fears about an earthly challenge to Roman rule, but is preparing to tell him something much weightier. Pilate asks the follow-up question in verse 37, "So you are a king?" Because Jesus is only concerned with truth, he concedes his kingship. So in the previous message, we said he defined it negatively, but now he defines it positively. "You say that I am a king. It was for this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I've come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." Jesus specifically came into the world to bear witness to the truth that the Father entrusted to him. He has espoused this truth faithfully throughout his earthly ministry, and events are now culminating in the fruit of that truth-telling. He will be executed for it. Because the generation to which he preached the truth was allied with Satan as their father rather than Abraham or God, they can only entertain lies and must be rid of the truth, and this is their way to be rid of the truth, through executing him. They think they can silence it by crucifying the God-man Jesus Christ, who embodies the truth, but of course they are wrong. Jesus' last words here hearken back to John 10, 27 through 28, where he says, "My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. I give them eternal life, and they will never perish, and no one will snatch them out of my hand." Those who know the truth are faithful to the truth are on the side of Jesus, and they listen to and obey him. Pilate, at a point when he could have been enraged by the overt challenge to his authority and kingship, and his decision-making, simply ruminates, what is truth, right? Sorry, failed to... What is truth? Two amazing things are happening here at the zenith of the confrontation. First, from a purely worldly perspective, and we'll close with this, Pilate is the arbiter of truth in Jerusalem. Pilate has the power and the position to decide what is true about Jesus' life and death and what they end up being. For him to ask, even rhetorically, what is truth, is a profound momentary lapse in cognition that he can decree to be what truth to be whatever he wants it to be. Certainly, the words and fate of a backwoods peasant from Galilee won't change anything as far as Rome is concerned. Yet the conversation with Jesus has, at least momentarily, caused Pilate to forget his station and relationship to the prisoner. Second, and more importantly, when Pilate asks, what is truth, John makes it clear that truth is standing right in front of him in the form of Jesus of Nazareth. John's case for Jesus as the full manifestation of God's truth to the world comes to a head with the most powerful man in the land openly wondering about truth while looking him dead in the eyes and sentencing him to death. The source of Pilate's power, the grounding of his very being, and the answer to his question all appear immediately before him, tattered and haggard, the God of the universe in human flesh. Speaking of this mesmerizing encounter, the theologian David Bentley Hart writes, quote, "A man of noble birth, representing the power of Rome, endowed with the authority of over life and death," speaking of Pilate here, of course, "confronted," speaking of Jesus, "by a barbarous colonial of no name, no estate, a slave of the empire, beaten, robed in purple, crowned with thorns, insanely invoking an otherworldly kingdom and some esoteric truth, unaware of either his absurdity or his judge's eminence. But who could have doubted where, between these two, the truth of things was to be found? But the gospel is written in the light of the resurrection, which reverses the meaning of this scene entirely. If God's truth is in fact to be found where Christ stands, the mockery visited on him redounds instead upon the emperor, all whose regal finery, when set beside the majesty of the servile shape in which God reveals himself, shows itself to be just so many rags and briars. The full disclosure of God's truth, Jesus Christ, could never be muted by death and could never be fully ignored by the rulers of his day. Knowing what a privilege it is to lay hold of such truth, let us commit to dwell upon it, remain faithful to it, lovingly tell others about it, and set our lives to be enveloped by it.